Good afternoon. My name is Andres Guevara. My Colorado bar number is 30664. I'm alternate defense counsel appointed on behalf of Mr. Anthony Daniels in this appeal. There are six different arguments that I raise in the appeal, but I think for today, at least for right now, if the court would indulge me, I'd like to focus on the first three, which deal with jury instructions and the instructions that were provided in this case, because Mr. Daniels' argument is that if they were done properly, that it would have assisted in him possibly getting giving the jury an alternate to either a different charge, in the case of a theft charge, or to giving them a different theory whereby they could have found him not guilty of the robbery charge that he was ultimately convicted of. As the court's aware, Mr. Daniels faced four different charges. He was acquitted of three of them: aggravated robbery and then two conspiracy charges, one with aggravated robbery and the other one with robbery. And the first argument in the brief is the issue of the theft charge. Mr. Daniels argues, and I argue on his behalf, that there was sufficient evidence in the case whereby he could have been acquitted of the robbery charge. He ultimately was convicted of that, of course, but he could have been acquitted of that, but found guilty of a theft charge instead. The facts that were presented at the trial, and I admit that they're a little convoluted in a sense, because one of the main witnesses, the driver of the car, Ms. Jones, changed her stories. But in any case, there was evidence at the trial by Ms. Jones that there wasn't a plan, that this word scoping that she'd used to police officers in the previous interview was innocent in nature. And that's at least some of the evidence that she had at trial. Naturally, the prosecution brought out the previous inconsistent statement as evidence to the contrary. But Mr. Daniels, the evidence is, left the car with Mr. Lane, who is deceased. He's the person who actually goes into the cigarette store. And then there's some testimony as to whether or not Mr. Daniels went in any particular direction with Mr. Lane. The store owner only sees Mr. Lane enter the store, and he's the person who fires and shoots Mr. Lane, who ultimately dies. He does not see Mr. Daniels. Mr. Daniels' defense was that he was merely present. He was outside, and he didn't know what was going to happen inside the cigarette store. And there was actual facts through Ms. Jones that Mr. Daniels could use and point out the fact that there was no discussion. He would not have known or did not know about the fact that Mr. Lane was going to do anything within the store. Obviously, Mr. Daniels did not testify, but there were at least sufficient facts that I think could prove a theft charge.
And I think, Mr. Guevara, we probably don't need to go that far on your argument. I mean, what I guess we need to find is that Mr. Daniels, we're in a complicity theory, correct?
That's correct.
That I think, and Mr. Daniels would have to have the same mens rea as Mr. Lane had on a robbery, correct? So what we would need to say would that there would have been evidence to allow a reasonable jury to conclude that at least Mr. Daniels lacked the mens rea for force.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, that's all you need to get to in order to distinguish the theft charge from the robbery charge. Because in essence, that's the main difference here. Interestingly, as the court's aware, the jury, there was testimony provided by the store owner regarding force in the form of a gun, but the aggravated robbery charge was an acquittal.
And no gun was ever found.
No gun was ever found, and Ms. Jones testified, that's the driver, that she never saw a gun, and there was no gun that was found at the location or at any other place. So there at least was some testimony contradicting the store owner with regards to aggravated force in the form of a gun, despite the fact that he testified that he saw a gun, he knows guns, and one was pointed at him.
Can you help me, Mr. Guevara, in terms of just the record? As I recall it, the trial judge here said in rejecting the theft instruction that theft didn't really fit the facts or something like that. Can you help me if there was any more, and if the judge gave us any more information or detail about that? Because I'm not quite sure I understand where that necessarily was coming from.
My review of the record, I don't see anything else other than the trial court statement to the effect, and the direct quote is something close to, theft charge doesn't fit the evidence. And there was no other additional analysis that was provided, and I pointed that out in my brief. I don't believe that the Attorney General cited anything else that I may have missed.
Did the prosecutor at the trial, and I think I've read it, but I can't remember, argue that there was no, that it had to be robbery, there was no other choice, and if so, what was the reasoning?
I don't know. I don't remember that the prosecutor made the argument that it had to be robbery or there was no other choice, because if I recall, I think the argument that was raised by the in the closing argument dealt with the higher aggravated robbery. So at that point, my recollection is that the prosecutor was saying there was a gun, the store owner was correct and credible on the issue of a gun, and it must be aggravated robbery. I don't know that there was much argument distinguishing the robbery and the aggravated robbery by the prosecutor at that point. And so I think that the argument that that Mr. Daniels' counsel at trial was making is, and with making it to the court, is, hey, there are facts that let's submit theft as well. That there is an argument here that Mr. Daniels had no idea that there was going to be force that was going to be used inside the store, whether it was by gun or some other form. And that would, as far as Mr. Daniels was concerned, help potentially explain why he had money in his pocket when he was arrested. That was money that had Mr. Lane's blood on it. That an argument could have been made with a theft argument that would have explained to a jury that what we have is a mens rea that doesn't fit the robbery, the aggravated. Mr. Daniels may have taken the money at some later point with the intention to deprive the owner of it, but didn't have the intention to the mens rea to use a threat or intimidation or deception. And so that would have made the theft applicable. Another argument that Mr. Daniels is raising, and I think it kind of coincides with this, is that his theory of defense in this case was that he was merely present at that location, and that there were facts that would support it. Now, the complicity instruction that was provided by the defense counsel, I admit, did not include language in it that is already approved language. So, for example, the defense counsel's instruction did not include the word encouraged. So that I understand is, and I concede that that's something that the instruction should have included. However, the general point that was being made by the defense counsel with regards to the complicity instruction is that the jury should understand that those elements regarding complicity apply both to aggravated robbery and to robbery. And so my concern was that, is that by not doing that, a jury could read the elemental requirements of complicity and say, well, it refers to the aggravated robbery, but maybe it doesn't apply necessarily to robbery, so a different mens rea requirement would exist for robbery. And that may explain, in essence, why Mr. Daniels, who is not the principal, who is not the person who went into the store, the prosecution's argument was not that Mr. Daniels went to the store, could be acquitted of conspiracies, but yet ultimately be convicted of robbery, which to me was difficult to explain. And under these particular,
you don't appear to argue that you won the aggravated robbery charge on the basis that jury didn't find complicity. Rather, it's on the basis that they found no weapon.
Or a reasonable doubt that there was, whether there was a weapon.
That's right. The approach that was taken, it seemed, by the defense counsel at the trial with regards to the store owner dealt perhaps more with credibility. And so the record, as I interpret it, seems to deal on the issue of the gun more on the issue of credibility as to whether or not the store owner saw a gun or if he's making this up.
They could have also denied, I think this is your argument, the aggravated robbery charge on the basis they found no complicity.
That's correct. They could have reached that conclusion on the aggravated robbery through the issue of complicity, but the same facts that would have established complicity for aggravated robbery
would also do so for robbery.
That's correct. So they would have, because it would have been the same series of discussions. that would have taken place in that car. Ms. Jodes was privy to, at least part of the evidence is that she was privy to a conversation in which they say, let's go to the store and scope it out. It's just a matter of whether or not the jury believed her statement to the police officers or a statement at the trial. But it's the same set of facts. It's the same pool that the jury would use to make its determination. In essence, then, one of the other related arguments is that Mr. Daniels had requested, in addition to a clarification on the conspiracy instruction with regards to including the fact that it applies to robbery as well.
In the complicity instruction.
Complicity, not conspiracy.
You said conspiracy. No problem.
Don't go there.
Complicity. is the issue of the mere presence instruction that you requested. And our position is that essentially that was his whole case. That was his theory of the defense, that he had gotten out of the car, but wasn't doing anything with Mr. Lane inside. And that instruction would help have explained to the jury that, look, just being there, even if he had known that Mr. Lane was going to go into the store and take money, whether by force or some other form, even if he knows that, his presence, the fact that he's just standing outside, does not equal that he's aiding, abetting, or encouraging. The prosecution, their theory was he was acting as a lookout. There were no facts in the trial that Mr. Daniels was acting as a lookout.
Is there some reason why we should reject People versus Chavez decided by another division?
Well, I think that... No, I don't think that there's a reason to reject it.
But doesn't that, Chavez and Simeon and cases like that, don't that undermine your argument on the mere presence instruction? I understand what you're saying about the theory.
Yes.
Those cases all say, I think, if the court instructs on burden of proof and reasonable doubt and all that, mere presence is covered. And I don't know, how do we get to a conclusion of error in light of those cases unless we reject them?
Well, I think that, and there's my answer to those questions, I don't think those cases are wrongly decided, so I don't think there's any... the argument here on that issue. I think this is a little bit different than the Chavez arguments in that in this particular case, the mere presence argument became the core concept of the defense here. And if the idea is that this is the theory of defense that Mr. Daniels has, and there's a concern about it, then the trial court should have assisted in the drafting of instruction to encompass the arguments that are raised by the mere presence instruction, but as they apply in this particular case.
Facts support mere presence. Now, when I think of mere presence, I just happened to be walking down the street in front of the store when somebody robbed it and ran out.
Right.
Your client arrived at the store in the same vehicle, parked in the alley or stopped in the alley behind the store, got out of the car with the other defendant, walked around to the front of the store, the other defendant went in the store, your client stayed outside, the other defendant came out wounded, he helped the defendant back to his car, put him in the car, and took him to within a short distance of the hospital, got out of the car, and the woman took him on to the hospital. Now doesn't that stretch mere presence just almost beyond recognition?
I think it's different than the normal mere presence when you're just in the vicinity accidentally and you're not there. There are several additional facts that are cited here that may make it different. But in essence, that's how I would interpret presence as opposed to cooperation or aiding and abetting. He was there. Someone else drove him to that location. He happened to have gotten out. He could have an innocent reason. I know that there's no testimony by him as to the reason why he got out. But if he's just outside while someone else goes into the store, I don't know that that's going to be substantially different than the example that the court has cited about just, say, walking by a location where you're innocent. He was brought there by somebody else, and his argument...
He arrived with the robber. He departed with the robber. He assisted the robber.
Right.
That's not mere presence.
Then I think that the argument that that Mr. Daniels makes is, look, my theory is that that's exactly what I did.
Oh, he didn't assist. I mean, Judge Roy put that as your argument is he was there and that was it. He's standing outside. He had no idea what Mr. Lane was going to do until he hears a gunshot and Lane comes running out.
Right, that he wasn't, that's exactly correct, that he was at the location, he doesn't deny that, but that he wasn't there to help, aid, abet, or encourage Mr. Lane, whatever it is that he was going to do. And that's Mr. Daniels' argument, and so I think that it's still applicable for Mr. Daniels on that issue. I see that my time is up. Say no further
questions. Thank you for reminding me of that, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I just want
to... Excuse me, Mr. Pagan, I was just about to say your time was not on, but now it is.
Now it is, okay. I wanted to clarify a few of the facts in the case, or add to the facts that were given to you already this afternoon. One is that when Jones testified, Kathleen Jones testified, she said that the defendant told her to do certain things. He told her not to pull into the parking lot that was for patrons of the cigarette store. He told her to pull into the alley that was either next to or behind the store. And the defendant also told Jones to wait for them, and she waited in the car with the engine running for them to come back. So it wasn't mere presence. I mean, he actively participated. And also, the other thing was that another witness saw them run out of the store together, not that he joined his comrade on the sidewalk, but they both ran out of the store together.
You make, if I could interrupt you, Ms. Pratt, you make a compelling argument for why the evidence was sufficient of robbery, and I understand that. Why, however, and I'll just be very honest with you, this is my biggest problem with your argument. Why could not a reasonable jury have acquitted of robbery here? This goes to the lesser non-included of theft. I think Mr. Guevara makes a pretty compelling argument that the jury already acquitted of some of the more serious charges here. They were left with robbery. As I understand your brief, you argue very forcefully and well that the evidence was sufficient on robbery. Putting that aside, couldn't a reasonable jury say, I have a reasonable doubt as to whether Mr. Daniels knew that force was going to be used? Hypothetically, yeah, we're going to go in and rob the store, and they both know that. As far as Mr. Daniels knows, they're going to wait till the store owner's in the back and steal some stuff and leave. Why couldn't a reasonable jury come to that conclusion?
Because there's no real evidence to support it. It's a theory. I mean, the law on lesser non-included verdicts or lesser included verdicts for crimes is that there has to be actual evidence, not theories about how it could go, but actual evidence.
Well, fair enough, but there was at least some evidence of credibility questions on both the store owner, who was himself facing investigation for murder. There were questions about Ms. Jones' testimony and her credibility because she changed several times and admitted lying. The jury obviously found a reasonable doubt on the more serious charges. It would seem to me, arguably consistent for the jury to acquit on robbery because they have a reasonable doubt that there was ever a gun there. No gun was ever found on Mr. Daniels or Mr. Lane. So I understand what you're saying about theories, but there seems to be more than that.
Well, it's speculating about what the jury did, about the jury verdicts, is something that on appeal, we don't look at that. We look at whether or not there's actual evidence in the record to support the giving of that instruction. Because the judge doesn't know at the time that jury instructions are given what the verdicts are going to be. So he does it based on evidence in the case.
Sure, but let me, the evidence, and we're having a conversation, sir. Excuse me for interrupting. The evidence that, I'll play devil's advocate with you. No gun is ever found. You have at least some evidence from Ms. Jones that, you know, they never discussed case in the store. I didn't hear that. I recognize that was disputed. Take that evidence alone. Why not enough?
Because you don't make credibility determinations.
I know, but a reasonable jury here could say, well, I don't have any gun, I have the store owner's testimony being somewhat inconsistent, or he's under investigation and has a reason to say there was a gun. I don't believe him. Why not?
The trial court's not allowed to discount evidence from a witness and find him incredible as a matter of law. He testified that the money was taken by force, threats, or intimidation, which establishes robbery as distinguished from theft. I'm sorry, I need water. And since that evidence is there, there is no evidence to acquit him on robbery and convict him on theft. I mean, you need...
What about the complicity instruction? Couldn't they have rejected aggravated robbery on the complicity instruction and may well have done so with respect to the robbery had it been they'd been so instructed?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, they rejected the aggravated robbery.
Right.
Aggravated robbery is the only charge to which the complicity instruction applied. Couldn't they have rejected aggravated robbery on the basis they can't find complicity? And had they been told they could find no robbery based on lack of complicity, would they not have also rejected that charge?
I don't think that's necessarily true, Your Honor. First of all, the jury is instructed in jury instruction number one that they read the jury instructions as a whole. And as a whole, the jury instructions instructed the jury that, or instruction number 13 told the jury that if they were not satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty of aggravated robbery, then he might be guilty of a lesser offense, commission of which is necessarily included in the offense charged. Meaning it's wholly included, so it applies to everything. If robbery is wholly included in aggravated robbery, then it's wholly included in the complicity instruction. And so the complicity instruction did apply to robbery. But, the jury was properly instructed, and the jury was told that they had to read all of those instructions as a whole. I mean, that's the argument on the complicity instruction, that it was, and in fact, you know, it's almost incorrect to do it another way, because if you're going to say aggravated robbery and robbery in your complicity instruction, you have to include in that instruction everything that a jury needs to know about going with the lesser included. They need to know that they have to be able to acquit the defendant of aggravated robbery beyond a reasonable doubt. They have to know that they have to be able to convict the defendant. Well, use this to convict the defendant.
They don't have to acquit beyond a reasonable doubt, do they?
Well, I think the instructions actually said that they do. If they find beyond a reasonable doubt that he didn't commit aggravated robbery, then they can move to robbery. And I think the instructions
If they determine that it has not been proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed aggravated robbery, then they may consider robbery.
True. That's right. Then they make
that's a wholly different statement, I think.
Okay. They do. That's right. All right. So if you're going to put robbery in the complicity instruction, you necessarily have to put everything else about robbery that the jury needs to include. I know they read the instructions as a whole, but in order to properly instruct the jury the way the defendant says it should be instructed, and the way Bogdanov says it ought to work, the lesser included would have to be read into the complicity instruction, and that's very burdensome.
I apologize. Maybe I'm not understanding that. I know intellectually what you're saying, and you're of course a very bright lawyer. I have a concern that the jury would be able to parse all this out. I mean, my concern about that complicity instruction is the jury is told it applies to aggravated robbery, and there's no mention of robbery. And you're saying that the jury should have been able to figure out, looking at all the other ones, that it was necessarily included. The instructions don't say that. I understand we have to assume the jury follows the instruction. It doesn't say that every time aggravated robbery is mentioned, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you should also read in robbery. It takes a leap for an layperson to have come to that conclusion. And I guess there are all these other instructions that tell them the things you just mentioned. You don't get to the robbery, you know, et cetera. I don't understand the harm that making it clear complicity applies to all of the charges in front of the jury.
Because if you do it that way, and you put aggravated robbery or robbery, it's not ever done that way. It's always done with the greater offense. And Bogdanov says to commit the crime of what he's being charged with, and then instruct separately on the lesser included.
Bogdanov, I think, just says crime. I don't think it even says crime blank, right?
Right. It says okay. The crime.
Okay.
But not the crime and the lesser included. Because the lesser included, it isn't as simple as saying if he commits the crime of aggravated robbery or robbery, there are other instructions that go along with why you're going to use the robbery, and the jury needs instruction number 13. So you'd have to combine both of them all the way together in order to get the proper meaning that the defendant intends.
So would the better practice, in your view, just be to use the word crime and not get into any of this?
I don't know. I don't really think that's what Bogdanov has crime in brackets, because you're supposed to insert the crime. But I would say no. I would say that the jury can read that the commission of which is necessarily included in the offense charge means you can substitute robbery for aggravated robbery if you find what instruction 13 tells you to find.
I'm not dinging on you, but Bogdanov does not have the word crime in brackets. It has all or part of in brackets, so we can look at that. I appreciate your argument. Can I ask if we can go back for a minute to the lesser non-included on theft? You cite the Lucas case. Is that your best case as far as you could find?
Yes.
All right. Well, let me ask you on that. In Lucas, the court refused to give assault as a lesser non-included, as I remember, of robbery. And the issue in Lucas or the facts were the defendant was found with the victim's ring and keys.
Right.
I mean, don't you think that's a stronger case than here? How could you acquit of robbery when the defendant actually has the victim's stuff? Isn't that a different case than what we have here?
No, because it still says there needs to be actual evidence to acquit of the robbery. I mean, here, it's aggravated robbery or robbery. It's not theft. It's taken by threats, force, or intimidation. And this court doesn't sit as a 13th juror and make credibility decisions. That's what the jury's supposed to do.
But so here you're talking about the principal. You're talking about the co-defendant. The city's, admittedly, but I mean the co-actor. That's true. What you just said is true as to him. It's either aggravated robbery or robbery. Not necessarily true of Mr. Daniels, is it?
I think it is.
Well, let me maybe disagree with my learned colleague on my right. No gun is found, ever. There's a credibility challenge to the cigarette store owner as to whether he was telling the truth as to whether there was, in fact, a gun. Why isn't that enough to let the jury conclude no gun? And wouldn't that give the jury reasonable grounds to say no force, or at least no mens rea that force was going to be used?
No, because when the court gives the instructions, he or she doesn't make credibility determinations about what certain witnesses would or would not do. That's a jury determination.
Fair point.
So we're talking about the giving of the instruction and
okay.
Not speculating about what the jury
might do. But the question is whether a reasonable jury could have acquitted of robbery, right?
Right.
So at some level, we have to think of what a reasonable jury could do. So let me take the credibility question out. No gun is ever found. There is at least inconsistent or challenged testimony of the store owner. No gun plus credibility challenge to the store owner. Could not a reasonable jury conclude there was no gun here?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Now, couldn't a reasonable jury conclude from that no force was at least intended? It would be different if everyone said Lane walked in with a gun. That would be a wholly different case. Why can't a jury say, I conclude no gun, therefore I conclude or have a reasonable doubt as to whether they intended to use force?
Well, that's the only testimony there is on the record. It's aggravated robbery or nothing. It isn't theft because there's no nexus between the money that the defendant had and how it got into his hands.
But the money is consistent with theft.
But how? You need the how. You need the nexus. That's what the case
didn't have force. Give me the money.
Okay.
Whatever.
To me, it doesn't make rational sense that someone could walk into a store unarmed and demand money from somebody who has...
Well, let me posit it different. The guy's in the back room, and they walk in and they go to the register and it's open and they take the money and they walk out, and then the guy comes out and shoots him in the back.
There's just no evidence to support that. I mean, if a defendant could get a lesser non-included without being able to acquit of the greater and evidence to convict on the lesser, what would happen is the defendant could say, well, why not trespass? You know, why not say I'm on somebody else's premises and I was sitting outside? If you don't have to acquit of the greater and convict of the lesser, the defendant then can always submit a lesser non-included and get a crime or get a charge that's much lesser. He doesn't get to decide what he's charged with or convicted of. I guess that would be my argument.
I appreciate your patience with me.
Okay, that's what I'm here for. The last thing about mere presence is that the defendant says that because it's his theory of the case, he's necessarily entitled to it, and that's not what Nunez says. Nunez says that you look at all the jury instructions in the case to see if they cover the ground, and they adequately covered, I mean, just at a minimum, the aggravated robbery and the conspiracy cover that you have to do something affirmative accompanied by a mens rea in order to convict him of a crime. There are no further questions. The people respectfully request that the defendant's conviction for robbery be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. Written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.